This Friday, I buried my cousin, Buck. His real name was William Evans, but I didn't learn that till I was in my 30s, because he's only been Buck to me. At his funeral, his son-in-law stood up to give remarks of how Buck was always the protector in the family, willing to put his body on the line to make sure that others were safe. And I remember even as a child that he did that for me. You know, we'd go to our cousin Buck and say somebody was picking on us, and he only had two questions. What's their name and where they at? And at the funeral, his son-in-law looked out to a crowd of about 300 people, and he said, "How many of you have been protected by Buck? If you have been protected by Buck, stand up." And over half of the room stood up. People who felt powerless, people who felt fragile and vulnerable. Buck spent his life protecting people that he encountered in his community and making sure that they felt safe. In the gospel today, we have two of Jesus' disciples also engaging in protection, but it isn't protection of people that they're interested in. They're interested in seeking a position of power, protecting their self-interest, seeking a position of status for themselves. So Jesus is on his way with 12 of his disciples in this gospel for the last time. He has outlined for them that he will die in Jerusalem, and this path that they are taking is going to be the end of the road for him on this earth. And so he tells them that he's going to be handed over to the Roman authorities, that he is going to be condemned and mocked, spit on, flogged, and eventually crucified. They will take his life. But Jesus says, after 3 days, I will rise again. You see, Jesus never talked about his death without talking about the resurrection. For Jesus, death is never the end. And this is an important message when you lose a loved one. It's a very important message that Jesus gives, because he knows that he comes to give us life. And it's an important message, especially this week when I was thinking about John O'Gorman, who lost his mother last week. I thought about Mike Curry, who lost his stepfather. I thought about Betty Potter, who lost her sister 2 nights ago. And I want you all to know that our hearts are with you. But Jesus gives hope to us of life after death, the assurance that we'll see our loved ones again. So Jesus spends his whole life, friends, with his disciples, modeling for them his mission to overturn the value of the status quo of power, where we see constantly in our society adults valued over children, men over women, rich over the poor. So Jesus, in his ministry, took on the powerful to raise the powerless. He turned hierarchical patterns on their head. He hopes that he has done a thorough job with his disciples, teaching them that the first shall be last and the last will be first. He trusts that they've paid attention, watching him use his power to raise those in low places in life up. This is the team that he's going to leave behind to change the lives of those whose freedom society restricted, whose humanity and dignity was breached through the oppressive day-to-day experiences that they lived. And so this team will carry on Jesus' work when he's gone. So he wants them to be ready for a social and a spiritual revolution. So Jesus knows from experience that when you push to reorganize how power works, those who hold it at the top in his age and in ours will fight back. And we know that too. When we fought in this state to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, those in power fought back for a while. But we kept going until it became a reality at the state level. And while we are still fighting it at the federal level, research tells us that it will lift millions out of the working poor. It will reduce America's vast financial inequity and help boost our economy. When we fought for farm worker rights, those in power fought back for a while, but we kept going until it became a reality and the governor signed the bill. And as we now fight for the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, those holding power continue to fight back. But we will continue to fight until it becomes a reality. We will keep going. You see, we live in a reality where the powerful will often work to protect their stake in the powerlessness of the oppressed. So Jesus came to interrupt that pattern. He never gave up. He never gave up because a fight was waiting for him, or opposition or struggle, or because those around him feared change or targeted his life even. He was committed to fighting for the powerless, and that's what he invites us to do. That fight for the powerless of our world will cost him his life. But he has a dream for the world that is more powerful than his fear of death, a world of equity and justice and healing and love and compassion, where God wraps God's arms around the world. Jesus knows that God will be with him. And when we fight for the powerless of our society, God will be with us too. And so just as they began to near Jerusalem, these two brothers, James and John, referred to the sons of thunder, decide to light things up a bit. So they hang back with Jesus, and they pose a question that really upsets the rest. Now, you might remember that only a chapter back, when they were on their way to Capernaum, they were arguing amongst themselves, you know, which one of them would be the greatest. And Jesus thinks he has settled this question by telling them, you know, unless you become as a little child, you cannot enter the kingdom. Right? So he uses a child as the example. A child, one who has no social power. But they pop the question anyway. Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. Don't worry about the details. Just say yes. Now, I used to try that on my mother when I was younger, and that didn't work either. Jesus plays it cool, though, right? And so he needs more details. So he asked them, what do you wish for me to do for you? And they answer, grant that in your glory, that we may sit one on your right and one on your left. They ask for power and status in the age to come. Maybe they figured if they're to follow Jesus regarding reordering the status quo and power relationships down here, that if this is the end for him, they at least can hook up seats of power in the age to come. One on his right and one on his left. I just couldn't stop thinking of the stage play Hamilton when I read that line. You may remember this song in Hamilton's play. Not gonna fire my shot. Throwing away my shot. Hey, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'm not throwing away my shot. Hey, I'm not throwing away my shot. I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. This is my shot. So James and John take their shot, right? They take their shot. But they will learn a very important lesson about status and about power. But really, they're not much different from us. Because the truth is, power is always lurking to tempt us to use it in the wrong ways, to elevate ourselves over others, to prove our self-importance, to exercise entitlements that we are not given, to collude with oppression unintentionally. But that is why it's important to interrogate power and become aware of how we are using it, our power and the power of others, so that we can use it in the right way. This week, James, my assistant, went to a credit union to deposit part of a check that he had previously cashed without any problem before, because he was a customer of this particular bank. This time he went into the credit union and he handed the manager the check, and she led with, "Where did you get this check from?" Placing him at the very start of the transaction in a position of assumed culpability. She had no idea that she was assaulting his dignity, making 1,000 cuts because, as a black man, that kind of engagement had a history of being rendered suspicious, being humiliated, publicly embarrassed by such words for simply standing at a counter trying to do business. He now is being asked to prove that he is legit. And the cut was so deep when she informed him that she would need to call the writer of the check and verify that they actually wrote the check to him and that that was their policy. And so she did call in front of him and she verified the check, and when she finished, he asked her, "Can you tell me what red flags led you to deem me so suspicious that you needed to call and verify the check?" "Because I never had a problem before," he said. To which she replied very curtly, "Well, then the other tellers just didn't do their job, because this is our policy if the check is over a certain amount." He was so deeply hurt and outraged by it because he couldn't imagine that every time a white customer who came into that credit union with a check over $1,500, that the person or the place who wrote the check would get a verification call. So let's check it out. How many of you have had that experience? One person of color. So James went to his car enraged. He tore up the second check that he would have attempted to have a transaction with, and he went home in tears because his dignity was assaulted. And he shared that story with the staff, and we all said we're going to call, and we were ready to stand in solidarity with James. But then Mark Bennett had a better suggestion, and he said, "I think you should do a road trip. Go back to the bank." And so I took James back to the bank to discuss this event in an attempt to repair the damage that was done and have them hold the impact that it had on his dignity. We were able to speak with the employee who committed the offense and her boss. We laid out why this was not okay, what our future expectations were, and how this was a wrong way to use power. We could feel God holding us in all the conversations as they were able to eventually reclaim their overall goal to serve, to focus on the customer's experience, and commit to doing better, as difficult as the conversations were at times. James going back to that place of hurt showed tremendous courage on his part in trusting that God would be with him to address it. And the teller showed some courage in being open to hear how that experience impacted James, as difficult as it obviously was for her. We watched God take the conversation from defensiveness to openness, where James eventually received an apology from her boss and a request for a second meeting to talk more so that we might work to ensure that this never, ever happens again to another person of color. When power is used to cut into a person's dignity, it is the deepest kind of wound one can make. And it is an invisible wound. Wounds of dignity last a long time. And Jesus understood this. He understood the social impact of oppression to create these kinds of wounds. And that is why Jesus constantly restored the dignity of women and children and people who were sick and the poor and the vulnerable. I try to be aware of that for my own self, because we all hold some level of power that we need to often be aware of and interrogate. So whenever I'm to speak from a place of power to someone who holds less, I try to ask myself some questions. How would this feel if this was said and done to me, and I felt powerless and was already carrying social trauma from things like racism or sexism or abuse or ableism or homophobia? I personally practice how to say something several times in my head before I say it out loud, so that it doesn't cut into another person's dignity. Sometimes I get it right, and sometimes I don't. But making the effort can make all the difference in the world. So Jesus checks in with James and John to see if they understand what they're asking. He knows that with great power comes great responsibility. And how we use power and status has real consequences. So Jesus calls on us to use our power to liberate others, to free them, to care for them, not to elevate ourselves over them, to use it to restore dignity, humanity, not to oppress or breach the dignity of others. And we are constantly surrounded with opportunities to use our power in the right way, to bring healing. And we had an opportunity to do that at my cousin's funeral. 20 minutes before the funeral, it came to our attention that the youngest daughter of my deceased cousin's name was left off of her father's funeral program by mistake created by the funeral home. And when I went over to verify that this was true, she was visibly breaking down at the very thought that that had happened. So we had two options. One was to just apologize and go on with the funeral, or to use our power to get the programs corrected, delay passing them out at the beginning, and not add to her distress. So we devised three plans. The first was that Barb, Ruth, and Judy took the current programs and they wrote her name in. And they were writing as fast as they could. And while they were doing that, I asked Davis to try to convert the PDF document that we did have access to a Word document so that we could change it. And while that was happening, the third plan is that we figured out that we would call the funeral home director and ask them to make the changes and email it to me so that we could reprint the thing. Well, we figured that one of these plans would work, and they did. 5 minutes before, we received a new program. We put it on a USB drive, and we were able to print 100 new programs with her name on it. Barb, Ruth, Judy, Davis, and Penny were amazing. Together, we figured out how to use our power the right way with a minute to spare. So Jesus poses a question of his own to the disciples. Can you drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism for which I baptize? Can you endure suffering for the sake of the powerless? Without hesitation, they said, yes, we can. And Jesus foretells that they actually will drink the cup of suffering, and they will share in his baptism. James, we know, will be the first disciple to be crucified upside down, and John will be the last to suffer. But Jesus makes it clear that he cannot grant this request. He points out that he has no power to bestow such a thing for future honors in God's realm. God will decide, Jesus says, who's on the left and who's on the right. But we do know that at Jesus' crucifixion, that the people on Jesus' right and his left were two thieves. And Jesus looked at one of them and said, "Today, you will be with me in paradise." People who were living at the lowest rung of the social ladder of powerlessness. So when the 10 hear this conversation between James and John with Jesus, they become indignant. One must wonder, is it because they asked first? But Jesus summons them, and he knows that this is a teachable moment. And so he points out the usual mode of power relationships among Gentiles of his day, amongst the Romans and humans, that it was for the powerful to order the less powerful to serve them. And he says to them, "But for you, it shall not be that way. Rather, whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant. Whoever wishes to be the first will be the slave of all. For the Son of Humanity did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for the many." Those with the least power in Jesus' world were the women, the children, the sick, the poor, the oppressed, the enslaved. Jesus' words are what brings us back to what's important. He defines greatness by servitude and how we use the power we have, not by the status and the power we hold. Not only did Jesus not want the disciples to replicate the power structure of this powerful world in their group by lording it over each other, but they were to reverse the power structure by serving those in greater need than themselves, even putting themselves at risk if need be. One of the people who I think of who carries that level of selflessness is my Aunt Renetta. This week, we also buried her, and she was one of the most selfless people that I knew. As her mother became more frail with dementia and losing the power to take care of herself and her disabled son, who also did not have the power to take care of himself, she took an early retirement. She uprooted from California, moved to Rochester to take care of them devotedly. She put her personal life on hold, and sometimes she didn't even have enough for herself. She would borrow from other people, but she made sure that they had everything that they needed. She endured her own personal suffering for the sake of those who held less power. She did it out of love. She held the power in the relationship, and she used it to serve. So Jesus lets us know today, friends, that the way of participating in God's power is for us to be willing to serve those with less power and less status than ourselves, to buy into this new configuration of family. You may all know Sister Grace Miller. She is another person who lives out this teaching that Jesus gives us, who models this servant leaderhood. Recently, Sister Grace called for everybody, for leaders and community members. She called for a community meeting to meet to talk about homelessness. She said, "We must have a plan to take care of the homeless before the weather gets cold and people are at risk." And so she gave them till October 15th, but Sister Grace said, "We need all hands on deck." And so she called for hotel owners and the homeless organizations that work with the homeless. She called for politicians to come to the meeting and those of us in the community to bring all hands on deck to address this problem. Because she knew that House of Mercy often becomes the default setting to take the homeless when no one else will take them. And so she gave them the deadline for October 15th, which was Friday. But if you know Sister Grace, she had a backup plan. We have a second meeting on Monday, October 18th at 6 o'clock to come up with a plan so that the whole community can wrap their arms around the homeless. Sister Grace uses the power in her life to be the servant to others. And finally, Spiritus, I think of you. You use your power every day to serve those in our prison outreach, to serve those in the hospitals in Haiti, the mission ministries for our children, our families in Chiapas, refugees, those struggling with mental illness and addiction, caring for aging parents and relatives and sick children and employees and students. And when I made the announcement about the children, the transportation crisis in the city school district, many of you emailed and called right away and said, "I'll do it. I will stand and post myself so children can walk to school safely." Jesus invites us, continues to invite us, and the disciples today to keep joining him in serving the least among us, because that is what it means to be great in the kingdom of God, to be a servant leader with Jesus, the one who washes the feet of the disciples, the one who feeds those who are hungry, one who healed and visited the sick. You see, it was Jesus' way of life, not his death, that frees the oppressed. And it is how we will live our lives that will free them too. In the right here and the right now.